Air travel used to be a pleasure, the epitome of elegance and glamour. Flights were not crowded and usually on time. Passengers were polite and well-dressed, and the job of stewardess was one to envy. Now a trip to the airport can be filled with dread of anticipated waits, discomfort, and rudeness. What happened? Well, after working 7 years as a flight management professional, William J. McGee became a travel journalist for Consumer Reports, and he writes about the changes in his new book, Attention All Passengers, which examines the economic and political forces that helped to destroy the airlines and explores the question of how they can be improved. It's published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased it has brought William J. McGee to our show today. Hello.
Thanks very much for having me on, Leonard.
What does a flight management professional do?
Well, I worked in flight operations for several airlines. I'm licensed by the FAA as an aircraft dispatcher. And when I worked for Pan Am Shuttle, my responsibility was sort of running the airlines, sort of like running an electric train set. I got to decide which flights would operate or have to be canceled or add extra flights. Very stressful job, but it was great because it taught me how an airline should be run.
Not as glamorous as being a flight attendant who travels to Paris or Rome every week.
No, not at all.
And when were you there?
I worked in the airline industry from 1985 until 1992.
So that's the period where we saw Pan Am and TWA disappear.
Yes, absolutely.
They had been the giants, hadn't they?
Absolutely. They were America's flag carriers is how they were referred to. They carried the American flag all over the world.
Was there a specific reason for the biggest ones to go under? Was it deregulation, or was it just that they had become too bloated?
Yes, I think after airline deregulation in 1978, some domestic airlines responded very well and grew, like American and Delta and United, and others like American and TWA, excuse me, Pan Am and TWA and Eastern, they went under. And in many ways, they really couldn't adjust to the new environment.
Well, let's talk about deregulation. What were the good things about regulation? What were the bad things?
Sure. I don't think many people today realize just how involved the U.S. government was in the airline business. They not only determined which airlines would fly on which routes and at what times, but even determined the pricing on every fare. I had a former government employee tell me that they joked that they had a dartboard where they would just throw darts and decide what the fare would be from Cleveland to San Francisco. But in 1978, under President Jimmy Carter, and in legislation that was shepherded by Senator Ted Kennedy, it was decided that the free market would run the airline industry.
So that wasn't Republicans, it was Democrats who
Absolutely.
Did this. Had the airline industry been really profitable before deregulation?
The profits were sort of baked in because, the pricing was determined by the government. So, it was kind of hard to lose money, in fact.
But also it guaranteed that certain cities would be served because once deregulation came into effect, airlines said, well, you know, we're not making any money going to St. Louis, so we're just going to drop those flights. And they could do that.
Right, absolutely. And the hardcore proponents of deregulation have often talked about how pricing has dropped in certain markets. But there's a flip side to that. And in other markets, in fact, pricing has gone up because where you don't have low-fare competition, where you don't have a JetBlue or a Frontier or a Southwest, the major airlines tend to gouge you.
The deregulation was aimed at helping the consumer by encouraging competition, but the opposite has happened?
Well, I think, it's been a mixed bag. There's no question that there were more people flying than ever before, and it democratized the entire process. But at the same time, what I'm most concerned about is the free market forces that were unleashed. We still haven't hit bottom as far as cost cutting.
Well, democratization has had other kinds of impact. People used to dress up to fly, or go to the theater for that matter, because they considered it something special. They no longer consider it special.
No, you're absolutely right. I write about that in Attention All Passengers. I talk about the fact that when I was 5 years old, I went to the airport the first time in a suit and tie and a white shirt, and I wasn't even flying. I was there to pick up my brother coming home from the service.
And do you think people dress down now because it's become such a downscale experience?
Well, I think the airline industry itself has a lot to do with that. You know, you're not imagining things if you think the planes are more crowded than they ever were. Throughout the entire history of the industry, it basically had about a 60% load factor, as they say, in terms of the occupied seats. Now, in recent years, we've been at over 80% average. So many flights are at 100%. Cramming all those people into these planes has sort of stressed the system, and it's led to a lot of the problems that we see now with air rage, in my view.
Yeah, well, if I were an airline, wouldn't I want to fill up every flight? First of all, it would lead to more efficiency, and with the high cost of fuel over the years, maybe it's a little lower this moment, but it's been pretty high for a long time, that would mean that I'd be saving money.
Well, the problem is when you run a transportation system, you also have to account for things going wrong. And when on paper everything goes perfectly, I can tell you as a former airline dispatcher that you sort of have to account for when weather or air traffic control or maintenance problems or crew problems affect you. So when we have these very high load factors now, we haven't really budgeted for things going wrong. So now when things go wrong, they go very wrong very quickly. And that leads to a lot of delays and a lot of cancellations, a lot of bumped passengers, a lot of lost luggage.
Some airline executives still claim that the airlines are the most regulated, deregulated industry there is. Do you agree?
No, I don't. The fact is, when it suits them, airline executives are more than happy to say that, as they did in 2001 when they went to Congress and asked for a bailout shortly after September 11th. The fact is, unfortunately, I believe we need more regulation, and we certainly need the Federal Aviation Administration to do a better job of overseeing safety.
My guest is William J. McGee. His book, Attention All Passengers, The Airline's Dangerous Descent and How to Reclaim Our Skies. Why is it impossible for airlines to make money? They all seem to be losing money hand over fist.
And that's not a recent development. In fact, if you look at the history of the industry over time, the industry has lost more money than it's made. A few years ago.
How do they stay in business?
Well, some of them haven't. I mean, we've lost hundreds of airlines just since 1978 in the United States. The trade organization lists over 200 airlines that have gone bankrupt. We've also seen rapid consolidation in recent years where names like Northwest and TWA have been merged into other carriers. The fact is, a few years ago, Warren Buffett had a quote where he said that if a capitalist had been present at Kitty Hawk, he should have shot Orville right down.
He had invested in airlines.
He had,
for a
and
while.
He said he never will again. He lost money on America West.
So the airlines aren't making money for their investors. The passengers are uncomfortable and unhappy. The workers, as you also write about in this book, are miserable. Does that sum it up? Is anybody pleased?
I think the only people that may be pleased are short-term investors who go in and make a few bucks and then get out. But again, as a long-term investment, it's not working.
Luggage has become a big issue, both the fees that you pay,
right,
and also lost luggage.
Right.
How common an occurrence is lost luggage?
It's quite common, and as I say, with the higher loads that we have now, it's led to more problems. Last year, I visited a facility in Alabama called the Lost Luggage Center, and that's where all of the lost luggage that's unclaimed in the United States winds up eventually. It's pried open, and then they sell the contents in a store that's about the size of four Walmarts.
Well, I'm sure people claim that lost luggage. How come it doesn't get to them? The airlines know our addresses.
They
know probably a lot more about me than I would even want them to know.
They absolutely know an awful lot about you and your buying patterns if you used a credit card and you bought online. But the fact is, thousands of bags every day wind up unclaimed, and they're lost, they're pilfered, they're stolen. In some cases, they can't find their owners.
Although people are checking fewer bags, aren't they?
They are, because of the fees that you mentioned. If you look at any survey about the industry, it is the number one consumer complaint is the fees, particularly for baggage fees. There are only two airlines in the United States, Southwest and JetBlue, that don't charge for the first checked bag, and Southwest also doesn't charge for the second checked bag.
But that's different if you're going to Europe, for example.
Yes, there are different allowances for international flights, but domestically, all airlines except for those two charge for checked bags.
Who keeps the statistics on lost luggage? The airlines?
No, it's the United States Department of Transportation. They do monthly rankings in terms of consumer complaints, flight delays, cancellations, lost luggage. The problem is those statistics have gotten quite muddied because of so much regional flying, the mainline airlines outsourcing flying to regional carriers, and it gets we start comparing apples and oranges.
Well, we wind up thinking we're flying American Airlines, and we're really flying some cockamamie airline as we have been hearing, with a pilot who may have had minimal training.
There's an entire chapter in Attention All Passengers on this issue. The fact is, whether you look at it from a comfort and service standpoint or you look at it from a safety standpoint, there's supposed to be one standard, but there isn't. You're buying your ticket through Delta or United or U.S. Airways or American, but you're flying on Colgan or Chautauqua or Atlantic Southeast or Comair. And it's not the same experience.
Well, why aren't they held to the same standards as the bigger airlines?
That's what some of us are suggesting, and I recommend that in this book. The fact is, I think the airlines should be responsible for the safety of their regional carriers. Unfortunately, what we've seen in recent years, when there's a fatal accident on a regional airline, the mainline carrier tends to distance itself and says, "Well, don't speak to us. Speak to the regional."
Even though their name is often on
Absolutely.
The airplane.
Absolutely, the name is on the side of the airplane. The name was on the, you know, is on your credit card receipt when you booked the flight.
What role has the Department of Homeland Security played in the matter of luggage?
Well, of course, they are now responsible for the screening of luggage that the airlines themselves used to be. So since September 11th, since about 2002, the Transportation Security Administration now screens luggage. Unfortunately, their record is rather poor, and there have been many incidents of pilferage and thievery right from the luggage now that they're taking care of it.
And I gather that when they confiscate that hand cream or whatever, they actually can sell it afterward. They told me that they were throwing it in the garbage, but it turns out I just read the other day that they're actually selling this stuff at auction.
I read the same report. I just gave up a Tom's of Maine tube of toothpaste myself about a month ago. It happens to all of us once in a while. You forget that your toiletries are oversized.
Is it true that if the airline loses your luggage, they're not obligated to refund your baggage fee?
That's right. And, that's real salt in the wound for many passengers.
Do you get any compensation?
Well, there is compensation that's dictated by the Department of Transportation. But that extra baggage fee, that $25 or $50 fee you paid to check it in the first place, again, that's the real salt in the wound for many passengers.
Because we would assume that kind of protects us.
Absolutely. Now, you know, the reasoning behind the fees is that airline executives will tell you that they are breaking out. They are unbundling their pricing so that if you choose to check a bag and I choose not to, why should we both have to pay, you know, for that service? It requires handling. It requires extra fuel to carry the baggage. That's a good theory, but unfortunately for most carriers, the pricing is just so complex that you really don't see that $25 come back to you.
But they want you to take a big trip, and a big trip usually means taking more luggage, doesn't it?
And yet an airline executive will say to you, that's an option. That's not a necessity. I don't know how a family of four could go away for a week and not check a bag. I certainly couldn't.
William J. McGee is my guest. He is a travel journalist for Consumer Reports, former editor of Consumer Reports Travel Letter. In 2010, the U.S. Secretary of Transportation chose him as the lone consumer advocate on the Future of Aviation Advisory Committee. He's written a book called Attention All Passengers, The Airline's Dangerous Descent and How to Reclaim Our Skies. It's published by Harper. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with William J. McGee of Consumer Reports. He's written a book called Attention All Passengers, The Airline's Dangerous Descent and How to Reclaim Our Skies. It's published by Harper. You spent some time talking to Stephen Slater, who became kind of famous for screaming at the passengers. He was an airline attendant and then popping the slide and leaving the plane. How did he describe or defend his outburst?
Right. Well, I think he was surprised that his actions resonated the way they did. And he said to me he was surprised to hear from so many people in the industry, employees, who feel similar frustrations.
On the other hand, I'm assuming he'll never get another job in the airline industry.
No, I don't see him ever working for an airline ever again. I had a problem with his action in popping the slide because that's a dangerous thing to do. But I did want to look at the deeper issue, the systemic problems of what's led to air rage on the part of passengers and on the part of employees. And so he was a good person to speak to because I think he was very articulate in speaking about what's happened to this industry. From a labor perspective, it's absolutely been decimated in the last 10 or 20 years. There have been so many layoffs, so many furloughs, as the airline industry calls it, so much outsourcing, that it's a completely different industry than the one I worked in 20 years ago. That sounds like hyperbole, but it's not. There's so many functions now that are outsourced. And when you walk up to a ticket counter and you have a problem and you want to change your flight or there's been a delay or something, and you say, well, I'll speak to someone, that person you're speaking to may be wearing the uniform of a major airline. But in fact, they may work for an outside service company and they were just hired 2 weeks ago at minimum wage and they don't have the training and the skills to fully help you.
Well, there's outsourcing on all sorts of levels, isn't there? Maintenance Absolutely. Is a major one. In the past, the airlines had their own maintenance crews. And now what do they do? Send them off to Asia to have them looked over?
They absolutely do. And in fact, I think this is the most serious problem I address in attention to all passengers is maintenance outsourcing. It's become an epidemic in the last 10 years. There was always outsourcing to a small extent, but now it's rampant. Every airline in the United States except American, and that's likely to change soon, now outsources most of what the industry calls heavy maintenance, the serious work on aircraft. And in some cases in the United States, in other cases in El Salvador, in Mexico, in Singapore, in China. And the real problem is the FAA doesn't have the ability to provide the same level of oversight.
Well, but what's the difference? If these people do a good job, does it matter whether it's done in El Salvador or China or the United States?
In theory, it shouldn't matter. But, you know, the key phrase there is if they do a good job. The fact is, the traditional model in the United States was that if a mechanic worked for an airline and worked on an airplane, he or she was licensed by the FAA. Now, increasingly, we're seeing that unlicensed mechanics are doing work both here and overseas. They're underpaid. They're unskilled in many cases. And believe it or not, the FAA does not prohibit unlicensed mechanics to work on aircraft. As long as one licensed mechanic signs off on it, then that's okay with the FAA.
But we're not seeing a spate of crashes. It's as safe as it's ever been, isn't it?
Yes and no. The fact is, you know, I put these same questions to the people in the front lines that are telling me how concerned they are. The frontline FAA inspectors and the mechanics at the airlines are telling me that we are in uncharted territory. Planes are built better than they ever have been. There's no question we have a safe statistical record. But we're starting to see incidents. We're starting to see undocumented problems. I spoke to one former airline mechanic who runs a shadow FAA out of his kitchen. He traces media reports of emergency landings, smoke in the cabin, things like that. And then he goes and follows up with the FAA's database, and he finds that overwhelmingly these incidents aren't even in the database. So we're in uncharted territory here.
Sully Sullenberger, who became famous for his heroic landing of a plane in the Hudson River, has quit flying, but he's become an advocate for all sorts of safety measures being implemented. He talks to Congress, right. But has anything changed?
No, not much has changed, unfortunately. Captain Sullenberger was kind enough to give an endorsement for Attention All Passengers on the back cover of the book. And, you know, he said on the day that he retired from U.S. Airways, he said, I leave an industry that in every way is worse than when I entered it.
Now, I don't remember comfort in economy class ever being one of the possibilities. I'm a tall guy. My knees always seem to be banging up against the seat in front of me. The only comfortable seats are the ones in the exit rows. And now they're charging you to sit in an exit row.
Of course. Or in some cases, they charge you to sit in a window seat or in an aisle seat. You know, if there's anything that they can do, the industry calls it ancillary revenue. Most people call it nickel and diming. Whatever they can do, they will.
But different carriers have different seat widths and leg room, don't they?
Yes, right. The industry calls it seat pitch, the distance from one seat to the next. But the fact is, seats have gotten smaller over time in terms of the width. But the other factor is what I was talking about before, the higher loads. You know, in the old days, if you were sitting in seat A and someone was in C and B was empty, you probably weren't as conscious of being uncomfortable because you could, you know, lift up the armrest and stretch out a little bit. Now, with somebody in every seat, it just sort of, you know, it heightens this problem.
I would think that this would be a selling point for some airlines. I think JetBlue does claim that they have a bit more leg room than
right.
others.
Right. The interesting thing about the airline industry, airline executives have told me this repeatedly, is whenever an airline tries to offer bigger seats, better meals, more comfort, they're still priced, they're still priced with rival airlines that don't offer the same amenities, and they lose out if they charge more. So the funny thing is passengers say they want these things, but they all tend to vote with their pocketbook by booking the lowest fare.
many years ago, I was in the advertising business, and one of my accounts was Frontier Airlines, the original Frontier
right.
Airlines, and we couldn't do certain things. Like, we couldn't mention that Frontier had a perfect safety record because there was a fear that the day after the ad ran,
right.
there'd be a crash.
Right. Well, it's a superstitious industry in many ways, but, auto manufacturers used to be the same way, and then Volvo and others started advertising based on safety. I spoke to one safety expert who said that he thinks there should be more of that. He said it would be a healthy thing for the industry if airlines started competing on safety.
Now, when I try to book a flight, I'm stunned by the how many different fares are available for the same seat.
Right, absolutely. It's called yield management, and again, it's a complex term for confusing passengers. I've done many, many years of studying airfares on behalf of Consumer Reports, and I can tell you that after spending hundreds of thousands of hours looking at airfares, there is no silver bullet. It is such a complex and arcane pricing system. I asked one airfare pricing expert, since I'm immersed in this industry, I said, am I missing something? Are there other industries that are as complex? And he said, the only thing I could think of is semiconductors, which I assume most consumers aren't
in
the market
for. Well, how does it work? There's a whole bunch of different coding systems?
Yeah. You know, when you buy an airline ticket, there's a very long code, looks like a motor vehicle VIN number on it, full of numbers and letters. It may not mean much to you, but it means an awful lot to the airline. And that speaks to them not only how much you paid, which is critical.
Well, they're not going to treat me any better if I paid a little more,
are they? Oh, absolutely they will. Absolutely they will. Yeah, and of course, I'm not talking about business class and first class. That's a given. We all understand that those passengers
are
treated
better. They get champagne and steaks.
But let's say there's 100 of us and our flight has been canceled. If I bought a ticket that costs $300 more than you, I guarantee you I will be reaccommodated before you will.
Even if it's simply because I bought the ticket far in advance and got a better deal on it?
Absolutely. The bottom line is you paid less than I did. And also the channel, how you bought it. Did you buy it directly through the airline, which is what they want? Or did you buy it through, Orbitz or Expedia or Travelocity? Did you buy it through a tour operator or travel agent?
Is it any better to buy it through Orbitz or Expedia?
Well, I mean, you can find better bargains.
Sometimes I find that the airline itself has a better deal than Orbitz does.
Absolutely. The advice I always give is, shop on those third-party sites, but then go back to the airline's own branded site, Delta.com or AA.com, because you're liable to find a better fare there.
And you save money if you do it online. They charge you if you book through an agent. I would have thought that they would prefer to have an agent because then they can adjust things a bit more.
It's all about the hierarchy of pricing. And, the cheapest way for an airline to distribute its tickets is through its own website. They have to pay a fee to a third-party site, and they certainly have to pay for reservations agents, much of which has been shifted overseas. I visited facilities in India last year that handle calls for American carriers.
There are email offerings sometimes for a good deal, but when you search for it, it's either not to be found or available only for a few specific days, and that ended yesterday.
Yeah, well, I think, everything that you're speaking to has created a level of frustration with the industry that is at an all-time high. I don't know any passenger who ever buckles in and says, wow, I feel really good about my fare, because they have a feeling that the person sitting two seats over might have paid $50 less.
My guest is William J. McGee. His book, Attention All Passengers, The Airline's Dangerous Descent and How to Reclaim Our Skies. It is published by Harper. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You call the Irish airline Ryanair the world's undisputed low-fare leader.
Right.
How do they keep their fares low?
They basically nickel and dime for everything. The CEO of the carrier has gone to the media and suggested that he offers stand-up fares where passengers would not have seats and would strap in as they would if they were if they were parachutists in the military. He has talked about charging for pay toilets on board aircraft. It makes for great copy, and he's an interesting guy. But the fact is, those ideas have tended to trickle across the Atlantic, first to Spirit Air and then to the rest of the airline industry here in the United States. 6 or 7 years ago, I wrote about Spirit Airlines being the first U.S. carrier to charge for checked bags. And I called all the U.S. airlines and said, are you going to match this? And they all said, oh, no, that would never happen. Well, we see where that went.
And now they charge you for food. They charge you for everything else. I would have thought that the food would have improved when they started charging you for it. But that hasn't happened.
No. And
why does it have to be so bad? Is it because it's all microwaved?
No, not necessarily. I mean, you know, there are business class and first class meals that are fantastic. But, you know, again, it's about cost cutting. And the fact is, you know, the third parties, the catering houses, they'll give you anything you want. I mean, but
including,
you know,
a pin in your food.
Well, unfortunately, we saw that just this week. But, you know, if you're driving down costs, then it's certainly going to be seen there.
Now, when the industry first began, most of the pilots came from the military, didn't they?
Yes, absolutely. But we've seen a big shift in that in recent years. At one point, it was as high as about 75% or 80% of all pilots in the U.S. airline industry had been military trained.
But because pilots are a great expense to the airlines, they've been doing things to find other ways to get pilots?
Well, you know, now we have these two industries. We have the mainline airlines in the United States, and we have the regionals. And what we've seen has shocked a lot of people in recent years. At the regional carriers, pilots can be extremely low paid. And when the Colgan Air plane crashed in outside of Buffalo in 2009, it shone a little light on this issue. And I think people were shocked to see that the first officer on that flight was making less than $20,000 a year and was commuting from Seattle to Newark and, in fact, had to work as a waitress to supplement her income.
What effect did Ronald Reagan's firing of the traffic controllers after their strike have on the industry?
I think it was a watershed event. I think it basically sent a signal not only to the airlines but actually to all industries in the United States at large that unions were breakable. And we have seen time after time in the United States now with the airlines where unions have been broken.
Is that why Southwest can charge less than other airlines?
No, Southwest is an interesting case because, in fact, people think that Southwest is not heavily unionized, but it is. It's a very heavily unionized airline, but it has much better labor relations. Southwest is, in my view, in many ways is a role model, with the exception of maintenance, which they've elected to outsource in many cases to El Salvador.
They've declined to add a fuel fee. They've been running ads about not charging you for your luggage.
Right.
Why hasn't that had an effect on the competition?
Southwest is a bit of an anomaly. It's the only airline in the United States that has been profitable for the last 35 years. And they have managed to provide service that, while it may be lower service in many cases, meets the expectations of its passengers. On the other hand, I think mainline carriers have a tendency to promise too much and underdeliver.
You suggest that frequent flyer programs are Ponzi schemes.
Well, you know, we're at a stage now where more than half of all mileage is not earned by flying. Originally, the idea was these were called loyalty programs. You flew on an airline and you were rewarded for it. Now, of course, you can go to a restaurant or a florist or whatever and order something online, and you can get mileage for it. The fact is the number of outstanding miles is greater than it's ever been. It's in the billions. And, you know, trying to redeem it with, particularly when you couple it with what I spoke about earlier, which is the high loads, there just aren't as many empty seats.
Well, I gave up in frustration. I no longer even attempt it.
Well, and many people have. The fact is, you know, whether you're looking to get an upgrade, you know, to business class or first class, where there may only be 8 or 10 or 12 or 16 seats, or you're looking to, you know, to get a quote-unquote free trip that, you know, you've paid for by earning those miles, it's harder than ever to try and redeem.
What else are airlines doing to manage their labor costs?
Well, you know, the outsourcing that we've spoken about in terms of maintenance.
That's something
really
you dealt with when you worked at, for the DOT's Future of Aviation Advisory Committee.
I did. You know, I was there as a consumer advocate representing Consumers Union, which, of course, is the nonprofit consumer organization that publishes consumer reports. And I think the sense was when I was appointed that the DOT felt that I would be there to speak about tarmac delays and passenger issues, which I certainly did speak about. But, you know, as I said in the first meeting, I think safety is the most fundamental passenger issue of all. And when I raised the issue, for example, of maintenance oversight and the fact that I've been told repeatedly by dozens and dozens of frontline FAA inspectors that they don't have the resources and the budget to do their job and to inspect the work that's being done in China and El Salvador, for example, you know, the FAA repeatedly stated, senior officials said, you know, everything's fine, the system works, the oversight is there. The fact is we're in a whole new paradigm now as far as that goes.
And it doesn't matter who the president is.
Doesn't seem to. I have a whole chapter in Attention All Passengers that just addresses the money that this industry has showered upon Washington. And
even though they don't have any money and they're losing
money?
Yeah,
well, they have plenty of money for lobbying, I can assure you that, both on an individual basis and on a collective basis. And, you know, the fact is, I naively thought that some of the outsourcing issues would be addressed when President Obama was elected, because he campaigned on it. In 2008, he received the endorsement of the Teamsters, and he said he was going to do what he could to reverse the tide of maintenance outsourcing. It's only gotten worse.
Is that your major concern? What would you suggest when somebody is thinking about buying an airline ticket and has a number of choices? What would you suggest that they consider before they purchase their ticket, other than price?
Right. Well, you know, what I've found over time is that when friends say to me, you know, I've found such and such a fare. What do you think of this airline? Often I'll say, well, I have some problems with that airline, and I'll cite some examples. And then they often say to me, well, it's too late. I already booked it. It's hard to underestimate just how strongly people react to low fares with this industry. Most people have more loyalty to their toothpaste or their mouthwash or their shampoo than they do to an airline.
Well, I never understand why, when I'm checking out different fares, why sometimes a direct flight is less expensive than a flight that has a layover in Dallas for 5 hours. Is it simply because they think I'm stupid?
I can't speak to that directly, but what I can say is that, you know, again, this is such an arcane pricing system that I've spent so many hours of my life staring at flight screens, you know, looking at comparing prices. And after a while, you sort of throw your hands up in the air and you say, are we really throwing darts at a board?
What about the screening by the TSA? Do you think that that's actually making travel any safer?
Well, yes and no. I think in some ways we've certainly made it more difficult for someone who has bad intentions to get a weapon on board an aircraft. But my concern is sort of dovetails with what you mentioned earlier about the needles in the catering last week. There's so much focus on the passenger screening that what we haven't looked at is what's happening on the back end of the terminal.
What it's done, I think, as much as anything, is it's made people aware of whether they have holes in their socks.
Yes, right. Absolutely.
William J. McGee, his book, Attention All Passengers, The Airline's Dangerous Descent and How to Reclaim Our Skies, published by Harper. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much, Lynn. I appreciate it.